Flight MH370 went missing exactly 10 years ago. People who lost loved ones on that plane say Malaysian authorities have failed to find out what happened.
So why do they get off on solving the mystery? I don't get it.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Gaza is facing famine. The Biden administration wants to build a new pier off the coast for emergency aid. It's not clear how supportive the Israeli government is.
But I think there is a very strong sense that the Israelis are simply going to have to let this happen, whether they like it or not.
And remembering a hugely influential creator of Japanese comics.
Dragon Ball, Dragon Ball Z got a lot of people into anime, manga, video games, doing art, other creative pursuits. That's a huge legacy.
Those stories and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being with us. 10 years ago today, a commercial flight took off from Malaysia's capital, Kuala Lumpur. Its destination was Beijing. But on the way, the plane started going in the wrong direction, toward the vast expanse of the southern Indian Ocean. That's where Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 went missing, along with all 239 people on board. Some of their relatives have never stopped searching, as The World's Patrick Nguyen reports from Kuala Lumpur.
It's pretty surreal to touch what is almost certainly a piece of MH370. It's a plastic casing that would have held a TV screen in the back of someone's seat.
This is what you'd watch a film on the plane. When I found it, it had three barnacles on it.
Blaine Gibson is an independent investigator who works with relatives of MH370 passengers. Together, they've hunted down pieces of that lost plane from beaches along the Indian Ocean and handed them over to Malaysian authorities.
Of all the pieces that I have found, this is the one that brought tears to my eyes. If you were a passenger watching the flight route, as I always do, this is where you'd have seen it go dark. This is where the transponder goes off and there's no more tracking of the aircraft.
Anyone can walk in here, this mall in Kuala Lumpur, and touch remnants of MH370. Malaysia's government put them on display. There's a huge piece of the wing, a chunk of the tail. Some pieces bear the plane's serial number. Officials analyzed other pieces, down to the screws and paint and part numbers, to confirm with high accuracy that they are also from MH370. That's according to Aslam Khan, one of the leading Malaysian aviation officials who scrutinized the debris.
We had to manage with what we have, the wreckage and the debris pieces, and we had to do a little bit of reverse engineering.
For passengers' relatives, bits of plastic and metal is, for now, all the closure they have. Grace Nathan is among them. She's a Malaysian lawyer in her mid-30s. She urged her government to show off the debris, to force the public to remember this plane is still missing. Nathan lost her mother, Anne Daisy, on that flight. She still refers to her in present tense.
I never say that she's gone or that she has passed on. I never say things like that. I always say she's missing. So for people who don't know me and they're speaking to me, they are left with the impression that my mom is maybe away traveling and just away temporarily.
Also on that plane was Paul Weeks, a mechanical engineer from New Zealand and father to two boys. He was en route to a promising job in Mongolia. Here's his wife, Danica.
All I know is he walked out that door, we kissed him goodbye, said we love you, and that's where it stopped.
Danica Weeks is an accountant, now living in Australia. Her older son was a toddler at the time. He's now a teenager. The event is so surreal for the family, she says, that even her therapist isn't sure how to help them move on. Danica says she's angry. Malaysia Airlines is owned by the government. Its job, she says, was to deliver her husband and everyone else to their destination safely.
And they weren't. So why do they get off on solving the mystery? I don't get it. I don't get it. Sometimes I think I'm going crazy, and this is why I sometimes have to, my beautiful friend, you know, she said, sometimes you're just going to have to park it in that box, darling, because it's going to destroy you.
Malaysia's government did search for the plane with the help of China and Australia. costing more than $150 million. It was the most expensive, widest search for anything ever. After nearly 3 years and more than 45,000 square miles scanned, the government gave up in 2017. But others kept going. It was independent investigator Blaine Gibson, working with next of kin, such as Grace Nothen, who found most of the debris, more than 20 pieces altogether. They literally started by asking oceanographers where wreckage might wash ashore, presuming MH370 crashed in the southern Indian Ocean. The experts told Gibson, go to island countries off the coasts of eastern Africa.
And then I listened to the local people, the fishermen, the boatmen, who know their regions the best, as to where to look for stuff that floats in from the ocean.
That's how he found that screen casing, on a sandbar in Madagascar. It even has some fabric from the seat still stuck to it. Other debris turned up in South Africa, Tanzania, and Mozambique. But relatives of the passengers ask, why has any part of the search involved amateur detective work, carried out not by officials, but by curious civilians and grieving relatives? Grace Nothen says that is totally on brand for MH370. Nothing about this case is normal.
There's never been such a bizarre aviation tragedy. There's never been next of kin embarking on a journey to look for debris. But we want the plane found, and we were willing to do whatever it takes to keep the search going.
There is some new hope for a breakthrough. A U.S. seabed exploration company called Ocean Infinity, which has underwater drones, wants to scan a roughly 10,000 square mile stretch of the seafloor this year. It claims to have an updated analysis of the plane's flight path based on deciphering radio signals. They will need the approval of Malaysia's government, which did cooperate with an Ocean Infinity search 6 years ago that was not successful. But this week, Malaysia's transport minister, Anthony Loke, told me he's ready to hear Ocean Infinity's new plan.
Anytime. If they can come tomorrow, I will meet them tomorrow. As far as Malaysian government is concerned, we are committed to that search, and the search must go on.
Finding the plane in such deep, vast waters will not be easy. Minister Loke confirmed Malaysia would pay the company if they find the plane. He wouldn't say how much, but if Ocean Infinity does not find it, the company gets nothing. This is at least a shot at closure for the next of kin. But Danica Weeks says there's a much bigger reason to solve this mystery.
The real reason I want to know what happened is so it can't happen again. And that's what scares me, that tomorrow, you know, another wife, husband could send their loved one off on a plane and it could just disappear.
For The World, Patrick Nguyen, Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia.
In his State of the Union address, President Joe Biden announced a plan to address the humanitarian crisis in Gaza.
Tonight, I'm directing the U.S. military to lead an emergency mission to establish a temporary pier in the Mediterranean on the coast of Gaza that can receive large shipments carrying food, water, medicine, and temporary shelters.
The Europeans are working on this, too. Today, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen talked about setting up a maritime corridor for aid to Gaza.
We're now very close to the opening of the corridor, hopefully this Sunday.
These plans are short on details, but the politics of this moment are clear. The U.S. and its European allies seem to be reaching a turning point here. Hussein Ibish has been watching this story develop. He's a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. Hussein, the latest announcements from the U.S. and the European Union barely mention Israel. Are they sort of going it alone here?
I think there is a sense in which they are going to do this with or without Israeli cooperation. Now, obviously, if the Israelis wanted to interfere and block it, they could do that. But I think there's a sense in the Biden administration and among the Europeans that if the U.S. military goes ahead and creates a kind of a makeshift port facility or terminal for the purpose of getting humanitarian aid to the people of Gaza, that will be done really by the United States with the Europeans involved, and under those auspices, then the Israelis really are in no position to interfere. It's unclear the extent to which this has been agreed upon by the war cabinet or Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu or anybody else in Israel. But I think there is a very strong sense that the Israelis are simply going to have to let this happen, whether they like it or not.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. You know, is it clear if the Israelis signed off on this? And you're saying it's not.
It's not clear at all that they've signed off on it. It is clear that they're in no position to block it.
Mm. Getting aid into Gaza has been extremely difficult since the start of Israel's military campaign. Things are really bad there now, with aid groups saying malnutrition is already starting to kill people.
Yeah.
How big of an impact could this proposed maritime corridor have on aid supplies there?
It could be a game changer, because Israel has only allowed a trickle of aid into the north. And what you can bring across from the Rafah crossing, which the Egyptians still control, all you can do there is load up trucks with boxes. And that's okay if you're dealing with thousands of people, but not with millions of people. So if the U.S. does create a large terminal, a temporary port terminal that can substitute for the one that ought to be used, which is the Kerem Shalom border crossing, which is equipped to transmit large amounts of goods and materials, but is controlled by Israel, and the Israelis are not allowing it to be used. If the Americans create a maritime version of that in Gaza south on the coast, it could be a real game changer in terms of saving lives.
I mean, Israel has been allowing some amount of aid to be going in almost the entire time of the conflict.
Yes. There's never been a total suspension of all humanitarian aid coming from Israeli-controlled areas. There's been a very small trickle of stuff that's come through, but mostly it's been blocked. And most of the aid that's come through has been on trucks through Rafah, through the Egyptian-controlled crossing. But there, it's a matter of capacity. What can you do by just loading boxes on trucks every day? There's a limited number of trucks. It's very dangerous. Everything is against it. So what you need is something like what Israel controls at Kerem Shalom, but that's open. And the U.S. can create that through this naval facility, temporary naval facility. I think it's a great initiative. It can end up saving tens of thousands of lives.
So we're seeing the U.S. and the EU step up with humanitarian aid, but whose responsibility is it ultimately to care for the people in Gaza?
Well, it is legally, it's Israel's responsibility. Gaza is under international law occupied by Israel. Israel has all the weapons on the ground. Hamas is a quasi-governing and fighting force in Gaza, but it's regarded by much of the world, including a lot of the Arab world, certainly by the West, as a terrorist organization. Hamas is not, in other words, a credible address. The address is Israel. The address is in West Jerusalem, in the Prime Minister's office. They are responsible, whether they like it or not.
Mm. The U.S. is a major supplier of military aid to Israel. Do you see any inherent contradiction here with the U.S. continuing to supply that military aid while they are also setting up this additional infrastructure to deliver humanitarian aid?
Well, of course there's a contradiction. I mean, obviously. And the U.S. has a big responsibility for this. First of all, for supplying Israel with the munitions, resupplying Israel with munitions throughout the war without putting, you know, major preconditions. And the U.S. has defended this war at the U.N. when others, sometimes alone, has defended Israel's prosecution of the war. So the U.S. has some responsibility. But you can see how the U.S. has been trying to increase pressure on the Israelis to end the war and open the humanitarian sphere. And this is because U.S. policy doesn't really benefit from the association with this war. It's been a big hit to the United States. And this is a problem for the United States. So the U.S. has to come out of this looking like a country that has at least cared somewhat about the survival of innocent people in Gaza and tried to help them, if nothing else, with food, medicine, blankets, and tents.
Hussein Ibish is a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. He was briefing us on U.S. and European plans to step up humanitarian aid deliveries to the Gaza Strip. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. If you grew up in the 90s and had any exposure to children's television, you might remember this.
Dragon, dragon, rock, dragon, dragon, ball, sing.
Dragon Ball Z was super popular. It was based on the Dragon Ball manga, or Japanese comic series, that grabbed global attention. Today, fans of the Dragon Ball universe are in mourning. Its creator, Akira Toriyama, died in Japan last week at the age of 68, according to his studio. To learn about Toriyama's legacy and the popularity of manga, we reached out to Andrea Horbinski from Berkeley, California. She's the author of a forthcoming book called Manga's Global Century, A History of Japanese Comics. Andrea, what is the first thing we should know about Akira Toriyama?
The first thing to know about Toriyama is that he had absolutely huge influence on anime and manga, as well as video games, both in and outside Japan. Dragon Ball Z, in particular, the English dub, was widely available in the United States in the 90s. I was a child at the time. And, you know, it was inescapable, but it was also a really fun show. And it became incredibly popular among people my age.
You know, for folks who aren't familiar with Dragon Ball and the young boy who was on a quest, who was at the center of that universe, can you describe a little bit about what that world was?
The concept was a kung fu manga. Toriyama was a big fan of Hong Kong martial arts films, and his editor suggested that he should do some kind of kung fu manga after his first hit, which was called Dr. Slump. So Dragon Ball starts out as a adaptation of Journey to the West, which is an extremely famous Chinese novel from, I believe it's the 16th century. Toriyama didn't plan it out. So it became very funny. It got weird. There's aliens. Goku turns out to have alien heritage.
Goku is the main character, the boy on the quest in this universe.
Yeah. You know, it was an action manga, but it was funny. And the heroes were always these muscle-bound, hulking dudes. Whereas Goku is small guy. He does have muscles, but, you know, he's conspicuously on the short side.
Why do you think this particular manga series became so wildly popular all around the world, not just in Japan?
I think it was partly a question of timing. The dub was very funny, too, sometimes unintentionally. But I remember a lot of ads from in the late 90s and early 2000s with clips from the dub. Some of them became some of the internet's first memes 5 to 10 years later. I don't think any animated show had really depicted action that way before. So it was just this mixture of elements that really hit in a way. It appealed to people outside of Japan and outside of sort of the previous sort of narrow science fiction niche, which a lot of anime and manga have been kind of stuffed into in the United States.
How do you think Toriyama will be remembered by his fans and the manga universe?
In one of the few interviews, he did send something to the effect that he didn't necessarily care how he'd be remembered as long as he had entertained people. But I think he did entertain many people, and his works definitely will continue to entertain people around the world. And in as much as, again, Dragon Ball Z got a lot of people into anime, manga, video games, doing art, their creative pursuits, you know, that's a huge legacy. Goku even made it to the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade a few years ago. So he's already had a huge legacy in his own time. And I think that will continue. It's just a shame that he was so young. And as they said, when they announced his passing, still working on many other projects that we won't get to see, most likely.
Andrea Horbinski is the author of the forthcoming book, Manga's Global Century, A History of Japanese Comics. She joined us from Berkeley, California. People around the world today are marking International Women's Day, celebrating the achievements of women, but also reflecting on troubling gaps in gender equality. In Turkey, there was a grim reminder last week of just how much work is left to be done. 7 women were killed by their current or former spouses on a single day. That galvanized women's rights groups, who were banned from demonstrating in Istanbul today. As the World's Dura Buscarin reports, activists say that violence against women is getting worse as Turkey's government takes away protections for survivors.
At a resource center for women in Istanbul, there's a room for kids to play in while they wait for their mothers. Some come for legal advice, others to check into a shelter located in another part of the city.
Sometimes they hold their therapy sessions face-to-face here in those rooms.
Ebrar Nefes is a volunteer social worker for Mor Çatı, the Purple Roof. They run Turkey's only shelter that isn't overseen by the government, so they're able to accept trans women, undocumented immigrants like Syrian refugees, and people whose abusers have connections to law enforcement or the public sector.
It's an independent shelter, so the government does not know who stays in our shelter. We do not share that information if the woman does not want us to share.
She says their 25 beds are almost always full. Nefes says in recent years, Turkish courts have shortened the length of restraining orders against abusers, which used to be about 6 months.
You see it for 1 month, 2 months, even for 15 days.
Other times, Nefes says, perpetrators don't even face jail time, even when convicted of abuse. Sometimes they'll get a fine for assaulting their partner.
It is not discouraging for perpetrators. The impunity is at stake.
3 years ago, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan pulled the country out of an international human rights treaty to prevent violence against women. The Istanbul Convention had been signed 10 years prior. In a statement, the government claimed the treaty's brief mention of the LGBT community was incompatible with Turkey's social and family values. The Turkish government insisted it would pursue a zero-tolerance policy against domestic violence. But activists say the situation has only gotten worse.
Çünkü biliyorsunuz o dönem kadın cinayeti diye bir kavram yoktu.
Tuana Gençer is a volunteer for We Will Stop Femicides, an activist group that scours news articles and police reports to keep a national count of the murders of women. According to their list, at least 315 women were killed by men in Turkey last year. More than half were killed in their own homes.
Kadınlar öldürülüyordu ve buna aşk cinayeti. Böyle şeyler.
When we started in 2010, Gençer says, there was no pure concept of the murder of a woman. If a woman was killed, it was a love killing, an honor killing, a hate killing, a killing out of jealousy. Gençer says her group has also counted an increase in the number of suspicious deaths of women who are not officially listed as murder victims.
Kadınlar yüksekten düşerek ölüyorlar.
Women have died falling from heights like balconies or the windows of hotel rooms, and they're said to have committed suicide, Gençer says. But when we look at the case, we see there was a man present. We Will Live. This protest of various women's groups walked through the streets of a liberal neighborhood in Istanbul over the weekend. An annual night march in the city's central Taksim Square, scheduled for tonight, has been banned. Metro stations in the area were closed by 2 p.m. local time. But activists say they will continue to protest until Turkey achieves gender equality. Ebrar Nefes, the social worker, says ending violence against women won't happen without the political will to do it.
There is no collective decision that gender inequality is not okay and women cannot be treated this way. It will continue to happen one way or another.
The government didn't respond to a request for comment, but Turkey's Minister for Family Affairs has said that protecting women is a priority for her and that every case is one too many. For The World, I'm Derya Buscarin, Istanbul.
American troops are on the ground in northern Syria, moving around in armored vehicles. They've been there for 10 years, but after a series of rocket and drone attacks, Washington is talking about pulling these forces out of Syria. That story ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. When the war in Sudan began nearly a year ago, the story was about two rival generals and their armed forces fighting each other for power in the streets of Khartoum. The fighting between Sudan's National Army and the paramilitary group the Rapid Support Forces spread across the country. Roughly 10 million people have been displaced, and around 15,000 civilians have been killed. But there's also something else going on in Sudan. The Rapid Support Forces is credibly accused of widespread ethnic killings in Darfur. Darfur in western Sudan was the scene of mass killings starting back in 2003. The vast majority of the perpetrators have never faced justice. And the violence today seems to be a grim new chapter. Beth Van Skok's job is to try and do something about it. She's the U.S. Ambassador at Large for Global Criminal Justice.
In Darfur in particular, we have witnessed just an explosion of violence against civilians. And as you mentioned, it's along ethnic lines. People are just not safe anywhere. They're not safe in their homes, in mosques, in schools. We've read reports about RSF and affiliated Arab militias seeking out people on ethnic grounds, as you mentioned, literally hunting people, shooting them as they're fleeing for their lives, stealing everything, looting their possessions, and then burning entire villages down. So it's eerily reminiscent of the genocide that we saw in the early 2000s in Darfur.
The International Criminal Court is investigating this, and I understand that it's typically difficult for the ICC to get permission to investigate a conflict while it's still happening. In this case, the ICC is arguing that it can use an authorization granted back in 2005 to conduct an investigation of this current conflict. Could that investigation actually change what is happening in Sudan?
The prosecutor has announced with the explosion of recent violence that he considers that referral to still apply. And of course, that makes sense. It's many of the same perpetrators, many of the same dynamics of violence, many of the same victim communities involved. And so it's impunity for the violence in the early 2000s is very much fueling the violence that we're seeing today. And you're correct that the International Criminal Court prosecutors and investigators cannot enter the country without the consent of Sudan. And so they must do their work extraterritorially. Now, we can do this in refugee camps, in Chad, and along the border. In addition, we've really honed the ability to do open source investigations remotely. So it is possible to do investigations in a live conflict like this, but it is, of course, exceedingly difficult.
You used the word we. Is the U.S. working with the International Criminal Court to prosecute those responsible for alleged war crimes in Sudan?
The United States is not a member of the International Criminal Court, but there's many ways that we can support its work, and we have done so in the Darfur matter. This involves a whole range of types of support. We don't generally get into details to protect the prosecutor's investigative trajectory and the confidentiality of their work, but we are able to assist on the diplomatic front and do some information sharing in an effort to give them the insights into where the crimes are happening, what types of crimes, and who might be responsible.
Information sharing. Are we talking classified information here?
Again, I don't provide information about the specifics of our information sharing.
One of the people at the center of this story is Mohamed Hamdam Dagalo, or Hamedi. He's the head of the Rapid Support Forces, which is accused of widespread ethnic killings in Darfur. Do you think the ICC will eventually charge him?
It's an open question. Obviously, Hamedi is associated with the Rapid Support Forces as their head. So we know that the prosecutor can look all the way up the chain of command, and it's very much about where the facts lead. So there's a tendency to start maybe at more low levels and then gradually work up the chain of command in order to determine who may be considered most responsible.
So if any of those perpetrators in Sudan are charged, what would that actually mean for them?
Well, at this point, not much. There are some indictments left over from the first wave of violence in the early 2000s. Those individuals have remained at large because they've essentially remained within Sudan. There is no international police force that's capable of conducting a cross-border arrest. The United States is trying to be of assistance here. We have a global criminal justice rewards program. So we've been able to issue a reward for information leading to the capture of Haroon, who's a former minister of state and was on the Darfur security desk.
A lot of people worry, though, that the outcome in Darfur once again will be the same as it was around two decades ago. No accountability. What do you say to them? Why would history not just repeat itself here?
Well, this is the nature of our system. We don't have international courts that have the ability to exercise coercive powers within non-consenting states. And so as long as individuals who have been indicted by the International Criminal Court remain in positions of power and authority within their states, they can escape justice. Now, we also know, though, that political transformations happen and that individuals who may be enjoying safe haven may suddenly become persona non grata. Those of us in this field are playing very much a long game. And the hope is that evidence will be preserved for when proceedings can be brought because somebody has been brought into custody. All of that evidence will exist.
So I've got to ask, you spend your time ferreting out war crimes around the world. That can't be an easy job. What is that like for you?
Yeah, this was an enormous job on like February 21st, 2022, and it became a crushing job after Russia's full-scale invasion. And I do have a global remit, so I'm meant to be looking at these situations around the world. It's incredibly difficult. our job in my office is to look for ways for the United States to be supportive of these various efforts and to do what we can to advance justice.
That was Beth Van Skalk, U.S. Ambassador at Large for Global Criminal Justice. After more than a decade of war, Syria is a divided country. The government in Damascus controls about 70% of Syria. But in the northeast, the Kurds run a semi-autonomous region. In the northwest, opposition groups are in charge. Remnants of the Islamic State are thought to be everywhere. Since 2014, American troops have maintained a presence in Syria, working mainly with the Kurds in the north. But as the world's Shirin Jafari reports from the city of Qamishli, the war in Gaza is putting the Kurds on edge.
The days leading up to the holy month of Ramadan are some of the busiest for store owners in the central market in the city of Qamishli. Piles of fresh fruits and vegetables sit carefully arranged on top of vendors' carts. Carcasses of lamb hang behind store windows. Tayyiba Abdulrazak is holding up and examining heads of lettuce. She balks at the price and demands that the vendor gives her a discount, which he does. Placing the heads of lettuce in her plastic bag, Abdulrazak tells me this year everything costs more. Fruit, meat, bread, she says, all of it. Abdulrazak has 11 children, 7 sons and 4 daughters. Every day I pay 25,000 pounds just for bread, she says. That's roughly $2 in a country where more than 90% of people live below the international poverty line. Qamishli is a predominantly Kurdish city in northeastern Syria. People here are proud of their identity and the social freedoms that the administration provides for women. But the Kurds have enemies, mainly Turkey, which is a stone's throw away from here. Turkey considers the Syrian Kurds as part of the PKK, a militant group that it sees as a security threat. Last October, Turkish drones hit water and electricity infrastructure nearby and killed dozens of people. Abdul Aziz Bassam has been selling meat in the market for the past 35 years. The only time he shut down his store, he says, was when ISIS came close to Qamishli. He and his family fled to nearby villages. He says Turkey's recent attacks have terrified the people here. One major deterrence for more aggressive Turkish assaults is the presence of roughly 900 American forces in this part of Syria.
We're close to the American bases in Syria, and we just spot the American armored vehicles passing by. Remember, these American bases in Syria have come under attack by militia groups in Iraq.
Since the start of the war in Gaza, militia groups based in Iraq have been targeting the American bases, leading to speculations about a possible U.S. withdrawal. A spokesperson for the U.S. Department of Defense said in an email that he has nothing to share about an American withdrawal. About 3 miles away from the U.S. base sits the village of Ali Agha. 50-year-old Ahmad Ali lives here. He tells me the Americans come to his village on patrols. They ask if we need anything, Ali says, and we tell them we need generators for electricity and water. They leave, and nothing happens. The U.S. forces are not tasked with nation-building here. Their mission is to fight ISIS and train the local Kurdish forces. Ali says he does feel more secure with the Americans around. If they leave, ISIS or Turkey will destroy us, he says.
Very nice to meet you. Thank you for taking the time.
Nuri Mahmoud is a top military commander for the Kurdish militant group, the YPG. I meet him in the basement of a Soviet-style building in the city of Hasaka. The walls are decorated with wooden panels with Islamic designs. It's pitch dark because the power is out and it takes them a few minutes to switch on the generator. Mahmoud tells me the attacks on American forces have destabilized northeast Syria. Last month, six Kurdish fighters were killed in a drone attack on one of the bases that they share with the Americans. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan wants to do the same thing to us that Israel is doing in Gaza, he says, and he needs to be stopped. Mahmoud is watching the upcoming U.S. elections closely. He says he would like the next American president to continue to support the Kurds. Mahmoud says he hopes that if Donald Trump is elected again, he doesn't repeat what he did in 2019, which was to withdraw American forces, giving the green light to Turkey to advance into northern Syria. Back at the central market in the city of Qamishli, butcher Abdul Aziz Bassam says the American presence isn't really providing the protection the Kurds need. So he says whether they stay or go doesn't really make much of a difference. They have their own interests, like benefiting from the oil and the wheat, he says. He says he knows that because when Turkey recently attacked, the Americans stayed silent. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari in Qamishli, Syria.
This week, we've been hearing about the dark side of orphanages in Uganda from The World's Halima Gakandi, who brought to light serious allegations of abuse and neglect. As her investigation wraps up, she joined us from the countryside in Kenya to talk about some of the takeaways from her reporting series. I started by asking Halima what first drew her attention to the issues around orphanages in Uganda.
Well, I first heard about allegations of abuse and neglect against an organization called Aid Child that's run by an American missionary more than a year ago at this point. There had been discussions about it casually within the expat circles in Uganda. And when I heard it, I knew that I had to look into it because I'm American. And when there are stories that involve foreigners, it can be quite difficult for local journalists in Uganda to cover safely. And also because I'm East African myself, so I feel a big responsibility to cover these types of stories. So it started with one organization, but the more I started looking into it, it was clear that there were allegations of abuse and neglect and misconduct in a number of other homes that receive funding from American donors. And so over time, I realized that there was actually a bigger story, not just about these specific issues of alleged abuse and neglect, but about a whole system that experts have been saying for decades isn't good for children, but that donors oftentimes unknowingly continue to support.
So you spent about a year doing this investigation. What surprised you most as you were digging into this?
One of my initial assumptions with this story was that, okay, maybe these allegations of abuse and neglect are coming, are emerging because of weak legislation. But it became clear quite early on in this investigation that that was not the case in Uganda. In fact, Uganda has had strong laws about children's homes dating back to more than 10 years ago, which lay out even down to the amount of staffing, the types of discipline, the financial reporting that is mandated for approved children's homes. But a lot of people who come to Uganda to set up homes don't even realize that there are laws and regulations about how they should operate. And so I thought, okay, if the issue isn't the law, then what is it? And experts have said, as well as government officials, that part of the problem is the money coming from countries like the United States, which is driving an industry and incentivizing people to open up these homes that where sometimes bad things can happen.
Halima, the story we heard from you yesterday left us with a final point about how it's important for donors to do their research before they give money to places like children's homes. How can they go about that?
Sure. Well, first, I will acknowledge that this isn't easy. It took me a year of investigation. A lot of that time was being on the ground to actually see what the reality was in some of these homes. It's hard for, let's say, an American donor from Washington State, who's an ocean away, to know how their money is being used. I mean, a lot of times they're receiving these photos of shiny facilities that look really good, but they don't know what's happening inside of them, or they might receive photos photos of smiling Ugandan children, but after having interviewed the people who grew up in the homes, they say oftentimes behind that smile was something really bad. So I've asked this question to government officials, and they start with this. If you really want to support a children's homes, reach out to the government ministry in Uganda, which is the Ministry of Gender, Labor, and Social Development, to see if that orphanage or children's home is actually approved to operate, because that means that at least there's some type of government oversight in theory of that home, and that, and generally those homes are only approved if local government officials agree that there's a need for it to operate, and they generally have assessed, is that home doing a job to actually make sure that the kids are not staying there indefinitely. Ultimately, experts in this childcare sector have told me at the end of the day, in their view, there's no such thing as a good orphanage or as a good children's home.
So if that's the case, you know, you've reported that it's better for kids to be with families rather than institutions. Are there ways that, that donors can put their money toward that end rather than a children's home?
In the case of Uganda, poverty is actually one of the biggest factors leading children into these homes. People within this sector say support those issues, whether it's health care or education or poverty alleviation, and you'll be doing a better job helping the type of vulnerable children that you're interested in helping. And actually, that is what the Ugandan government has been trying to do. But people in, working in this sector here say that the flood of money that's going into orphanages is undercutting all of these other efforts.
The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gakandi is based in Nairobi. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Paul Salopek has been walking the path of human migration for 11 years. This sound is from the desert in Ethiopia on the very first day of that walk, as the National Geographic Explorer crossed out of Africa and into Saudi Arabia. The sounds changed. Traffic noises drowned out Paul's footsteps as he began his hike up the Arabian Peninsula. We've been catching up with Paul about his journey, which will eventually take him to the southern tip of South America. Our focus today is on his walk through Saudi Arabia back in 2013. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Carolyn, it's great to be with you again.
So what was that like going from the desert of Ethiopia, where you began your journey, to this concrete cityscape of the city of Jeddah?
It was surreal. Because on the one hand, I'm walking through the same ecosystem, right? I'm walking through two deserts. One is the Ethiopian desert in the Horn of Africa. And then I had to take a camel boat across the Red Sea and disembarked in another great desert, the desert of the Hejaz, along the Red Sea coast of Saudi Arabia. And whereas the landscape, the natural landscape, might look, even kind of if you squint, vaguely similar, ultra-arid, sand, sky, heat. Mm-hmm. The economics and culture changed dramatically, drastically, from one of that was mainly a camel pastoral economy in Ethiopia and Djibouti to one of ultra-modern development, thanks to the world's most massive oil reserves in Saudi Arabia, where there was a lot of poured concrete suddenly to walk on.
Mm. So a lot of poured concrete is obviously a whole different picture than when our first human ancestors were crossing the Arabian Peninsula on foot. I know you've done your reading on this. How did it look back then?
It was much wetter. It was, if you will, a green Arabia. And what archaeologists and anthropologists are surprised to find as they begin opening up new digs and new exploration in Saudi Arabia is it kind of looked like the savannas of a modern day Serengeti, you know, this kind of paradisical landscape of waving grasslands, lots of surface water, these jewel-like lakes, open woodlands, and large herds of animals. So that is kind of the prevailing hypothesis right now. Why did we walk out of Africa way back then, back in the Pleistocene, is we were being drawn by resources. As big droughts happened in our African cradle, people fled hunger and went where the protein, where the goods were, which is in what is modern day Saudi Arabia.
So now, of course, it is a very arid place. And as we've been talking, I've been thinking, how do you navigate that heat and that sun walking all across this peninsula?
Yeah, sometimes at night we had to walk after hours because it simply got to be too hot, close to 50 degrees centigrade and Fahrenheit. That's, you know, well above 100, 110, 115. With very little water, as you mentioned, we're walking well to well. And often cases, they were very ancient wells because we were walking these ancestral pathways of pilgrims to Mecca, right? The holiest city of Islam, which is located in that part of Saudi Arabia.
We're talking with National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek. Paul, when you were walking through the Arabian Peninsula, you saw the very beginnings of King Abdullah City, which was heavily promoted by its Saudi creators.
Imagine a city, a unique partnership between government and the private sector, at the crossroads between East and West, on the coast of the Red Sea.
That's from a promotional video. What did the construction site for King Abdullah City look like when you were there back in 2013?
Well, to be frank, a lot of big billboards. There was not much built other than kind of a visitor center and a grid of roads carved into the desert, awaiting investment to turn this place into kind of a new Venice, a 21st century economic Venice in the middle of the Hejaz Desert of Arabia. What I've heard since is that King Abdullah Economic City still hasn't quite taken off. Mm. Instead of a couple million people living there, I think it's just still thousands.
I'm curious, who a traveler is really impacts how they experience a place. In Saudi Arabia, for example, there are traditionally male spaces and traditionally female spaces. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on how who you are, or maybe more specifically your gender, impacted who you are able to spend time with and what you experienced there.
I think I would have to be in a coma to not be sensible to that enormous divide. And in Saudi Arabia, there are surface manifestations of gender inequality and gender divides. They're the obvious ones, the way women wear covering, what public spaces women occupy versus that men dominate. And it struck me very hard, long before I first set foot in Saudi Arabia, how the world is divided along gender lines.
So how did you see that when you were on your walk? What did that look like?
Now, Saudi cities are as cosmopolitan in many ways as any city in the world. So Saudi women living in big cities have more access to power, political, economic, et cetera, than women might be living in rural spaces. But what I had to do to interview a woman teacher in a small town was I couldn't go directly to her to talk to her. She was an art teacher, and she was kind of considered a community leader, a beacon of the community, a good soul, a good person, a strong person. I had to go to her husband to talk to her and get his permission first. And when he, to his credit, he agreed, when I went to their home, she would talk to me through a closed door. So we conducted an interview where there was a locked, closed door between us, and her husband was sitting next to me in the living room sofa. So that is, on the one hand, kind of a stereotypical encounter with a rural Saudi woman. But on the other hand, Saudi women that I've interviewed in cities, including one that walked with me, said, hey, that's also a bit unfair because you were applying these Western cultural standards to us. And in some ways, if we're not careful, also abusing us by also saying you guys are inferior, you're victimized, etc. When the woman who walked with me said, I'm proud of wearing an abaya. My mother wore it. My grandmother wore it. It's a source of power. We feel comfortable with it, etc. Right. And it's not the Stockholm syndrome. It's what feels good to you. That if you live as a woman in that society, you have to have a right to talk about yourself and identify yourself in terms of what empowers you or not. And I think having outsiders come and kind of point their finger may not always be helpful, right? It's very complicated.
Final question, Paul. This walk up the Arabian Peninsula brought you into contact with all kinds of people, from Saudi officials to Bedouin communities. When you look back on this leg of your journey, what's one thing that really sticks with you?
At the time and place that I walked through Saudi Arabia, it was an enormous sense of privilege. I don't know of too many other outsiders who traversed this amazing desert landscape with these 1,500-year-old pilgrim trails cutting across mountains, carved by millions of feet, camel pad feet, as pilgrims went to Mecca. In my memory, it lingers as one of the highlights of my global walk because of the kind of the rare access to a hidden landscape, such as the desert of the Hejaz.
Paul Salopek's project with National Geographic is called The Out of Eden Walk. He'll be back with us again soon with more about the journey, and you'll want to see his photographs, videos, and stories from some of the many places he's already visited. It's all at outofedenwalk.nationalgeographic.org. You can also find that link at our website. We are at theworld.org. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a great weekend, and we will see you back here on Monday.